This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's jump right into our week in review, beginning with a push by Boston Mayor Marty Walsh and his fellow mayors to tackle income inequality and to catch up with other countries by investing in transportation.
They are investing in new shiny infrastructure, whereas we're trying to just patch things up. It is not a formula for long-term success.
Also this week, an about-face by Boston 2024, which now says it supports a referendum on the city's Olympic bid.
I think we owe it to the voters and the citizens of Massachusetts to create an environment that people feel comfortable and have that sense of trust.
Plus, the Boston Globe reports that prosecutors who sent former Probation Department Chief John O'Brien to jail are now focusing on his Beacon Hill colleagues.
Simply the question whether those who testified before the grand jury were truthful in that testimony, and that includes a number of political operatives in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
And federal prosecutors get ready to rest their case against the admitted Boston Marathon bomber. Joining us now to talk more about these stories and the rest of the week's news is Nancy Gertner. She's a former federal judge and now a professor at Harvard Law School. Nancy, good to see you.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Tom Keene, former city councilor and current columnist for the Boston Globe. Good to see you, Tom.
Pleasure to be here.
So let's start off by talking about transportation. There were several things afoot this week. On Monday, Mayor Marty Walsh and New York Mayor Bill de Blasio convened a group of mayors to talk about income inequality and the importance of investing in transportation. The mayors want Congress to pass a transportation bill and to up the federal commitment to transportation spending by tens of billions of dollars, and they say this will help working class and poor communities in particular. So here's Mayor Walsh talking about the impact of the MBTA problems this winter.
The train lines went down, the buses went down, and the communities in Boston, Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, Hyde Park, they were affected tremendously by it, where people couldn't get a chance to get into work, I think. And what's really missing in some of our poorer neighborhoods in the city of Boston is economic opportunities. And if we can get our system back up and running, we have another incentive to bring businesses to those neighborhoods.
So, Tom, let me start with you. What's your response to this idea that mayors are making this economic argument, a class argument, to lobby for more transportation funding?
So I actually don't buy it. For one thing, when you saw the MBTA go down, the worst part was the commuter rail. And, of course, that really serves outside of Boston, mm-hmm. really serves a lot of better-off commuters and not really inside Boston. I certainly agree with the idea that we really need to have some significant investment in our transportation system. And I certainly also think that it will disproportionately benefit those of moderate incomes and low incomes. I'm not sure that's going to be the way to sell it to this Congress, by the way.
Yeah, and what about that, Nancy? I mean, this Congress, selling anything to this Congress, convincing this Congress to actually get something done, kind of a trick. But what's your response to the mayor's pitch here?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I remember hearing, maybe it was on the radio, someone talking about how they couldn't get to work. They had a service job in a hotel. They couldn't get to work by the MBTA. They couldn't get to work. They didn't have a car. They couldn't use their car because of all the snow. And so someone suggested, why don't you take a cab? And the woman said, that's my week's salary.
Hmm.
And it was a story that it seems to me symbolized why we have to equalize resources by getting the transportation better. And it's not only for the poor people. It's also a tourist issue. When Europeans come to Boston and you tell them that you can get around downtown with public transportation, but God forbid you're in Cambridge and it'll take a while to get across the river.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's really not a world-class city unless we caught up in that way. The question of how to sell this to Congress, this, of course, is another question. I don't know how to sell anything to this Congress under any circumstances, any time, period.
Tom, what about you? You have an idea about how to sell stuff to this Congress?
No, I really don't. But I do think, I mean, as they're thinking about transit, I think one of the things that the city could really benefit from doing is stepping back and looking at this entire thing, not only mass transit, but seeing how all of these varying new pieces that are out there, bikes and bike lanes, for example, new transportation modes such as Uber, all start to fit into this. Mm. You know, this couples up with the recent report that Boston has very few parking spaces and the number of parking spaces is declining. And we don't even know how many we have. It couples up with the fact that the city is now looking at doing bike lanes along Comm Ave as you go out into Brighton. I think stepping back and really thinking about these multiple pieces would really help a lot.
Well, speaking of that, I wanted to actually bring that up. So yesterday, the mayor talked about this $17 million project as part of a sort of transportation plan to help pedestrians, motorists, and bicyclists kind of get along together. He wants to put in this protected cycle bicycles, bicycle lane up Commonwealth Avenue, which is a very, very busy part of Boston where bicyclists have had fatal accidents and dozens of crashes in recent years. So here's Doug Johnson of the Boston Cyclists Union, who called the announcement thrilling.
I used to ride on this part of Comm Ave every day, and it was always a terrible experience, fearing for my life on a daily basis. I just want to thank you so much for what you did. I think this is great.
All right, so great. How great is this, Tom? This a dedicated bicycle lane. It's just one, but is it the start of something significant here?
So I, too, have ridden that, and my daughter lives in Alston and used to ride it, and she was so fearful for her life that she now just walks or takes the T.
And with good reason. It is
absolutely
dangerous.
It is really dangerous. And if you're out there, the cars are crisscrossing all the time. This is an incredibly intensely traveled section of town, and it is there's a huge demand for bicycles along there because of the BU crowd, not to most obviously. So I think this is a terrific first step. I hope it's a first step that the city really starts to think about throughout downtown.
Yeah, what do you think, Nancy? Heading in the right direction, this idea?
Well, I live around the corner, so I mean, I think it is extraordinarily dangerous. Actually, when I was a judge, I used to take my life in my hands and take my bike to work occasionally. Always wondered that someone was aiming for me, but that was another question entirely. I think that this is the way to go, but it really, I take a point from what Tom said, it has to be identified systematically. Mm-hmm. We can't justify transportation innovation in this patchwork quilt. You know, Commonwealth Avenue makes sense because BU is around here. The area of the city that I worked in, which was around the federal court, has now the worst traffic, fewer parking spaces, and this was an area that we knew this development was coming and could have been planned. So this has to be a system-wide approach and not a patchwork quilt.
Yeah, and I think that's what it is right now. I think every now and then they come up with a big project and sort of like, let's spend a bunch of money and put in a protected bike lane here, but where's the system, the sort of system that knits it all together?
It is quite a challenge. Well, Nancy, you mentioned that you don't know how to sell anything to Congress. How about selling the people of Boston on the Olympics? Let's talk about that, because Boston 2024, the private group that wants to bring the Olympics to Boston, this week, Chairman John Fish told reporters that the group now backs a statewide referendum on the question.
Opinion polls are exactly that. They're people's opinions. And at 2024, myself personally, I respect that. And to me, what we want to understand is that the information that the people are developing their opinions on are accurate, are thoughtful. And I'm not sure we've had the opportunity to address a lot of the concerns that people had.
So Fish implying there that by the time a referendum does get on the ballot, Boston 2024 thinks that they will have had a chance to address the concerns that people have. But Nancy, what do you think about it? Do you think that putting the question to voters is a good idea?
I don't think they had a choice. If the polls began to tank any more than they did, they would not have had a credible bid at all. And so I don't think they had a choice. I think they had to put this up for a referendum. And, you know, it is true that making it a referendum question sort of crystallizes the debate. It also could mean that they will flood the airways with their resources, but it's certainly a better debate than not having it. I don't think they had a choice. I think that there's no way that we could have gone forward with this under the circumstances.
So speaking of, Tom, the New York Times put it this way, quote, "This is among the most anemic levels of support ever registered by a potential host city at this stage in the process and could doom the bid unless it is reversed." I mean, so do you think, well, you know, whether or not, however the vote goes, do you think support leading up to it could be reversed if, say, a ton of ad money went into it?
Sure. I have a great belief in the ability of a lot of money to change people's minds. I'm sure that could happen.
Every 2 to 4 years, right?
Yeah. We see it every time we have a ballot referendum question. I do think in this case, however, the hard question is going to be for Fish and Company is going to be really persuading people that no public dollars are going to be at risk. And Scott Lehigh had a great piece in today's Globe today, kind of patterned after the Raven, I think. And talking about him and the ed board of the Globe meeting with John Fish and sort of coming away with the feeling they were getting fish tails and directly asking for some proof that there would not be public dollars at risk and not being able to get that back in response.
Right. I mean, it's a tough call because I think typically cities or states are on the hook for cost overruns unless they broker a deal with the IOC or the USOC. And who knows if that would be even possible to happen. I think Los Angeles managed to do it, but don't quote me on that.
Yeah.
But it's a tough call.
By the way, Paris is going to be having a vote as well on the Olympics.
Oh, really? Mm.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
Well, but it's also a question of how they pose the question.
On the actual referendum.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, also this week, more news about the probation hiring scandal. The Boston Globe reported that federal prosecutors want former state probation commissioner John O'Brien, who's currently serving an 18-month prison sentence, to testify before a grand jury. The target, apparently, are Beacon Hill politicians who may have lied to investigators looking into the patronage hiring scheme in the probation department. We spoke to attorney Paul Weir this week, who conducted the first independent investigation on this. And here's what he said about the long, slow pace of this investigation.
I think inevitably it takes a lot of time, and the United States Attorney's Office is careful and needs to be careful in terms of whom it charges and on what basis. So I'm not surprised at the length of time. I think it's very much worth it because public corruption obviously is a critical problem in the Commonwealth.
So Attorney Paul Weir there. But Tom, what do you make of this? Are there folks on Beacon Hill that must be a little nervous about this?
Well, there are. But this one, I am going to defer to the judge.
I'm kicking him under the table. Adrian Walker wrote an interesting column in which the gist of it was that now we can get the truth coming out. Mm. So step back a little bit.
Yeah.
Truth and grand jury in the same sentence. What's wrong with that picture?
Mm.
We've spent the past 6 months looking at grand jurors that were enormously manipulated in one direction by the prosecutor all across the country. So the notion that the truth is going to come out in this setting is an open question. Mm-hmm. And in any event, we've already had an almost a year-long grand jury, which produced the charges against O'Brien, a lengthy trial, multiple pleas, a sentencing proceeding. And so step back and say, what's the truth that the U.S. attorney thinks they're going to get? There is at least a possibility that what they're seeking is the truth that they believe, not the truth as it actually exists. And what they're talking about is they also understood that there were major problems with the O'Brien prosecution, problems which led the Court of Appeals to give him bail pending appeal, which is very unusual. There were legal problems. And so what is troubling to me is you're now going to ask questions seeking to shore up a case which you couldn't make in all the times that you've tried.
Interesting.
I agree with Paul Weir.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that this was a situation that called out to address for institutional change, but we don't use the criminal law after the fact to criminalize behavior that no one ever anticipated would be criminal.
Right.
That's just not the way we do it.
No, and you've expressed really powerfully on this show your feelings about the original O'Brien prosecution. So you feel that this is just going more steps too far.
Well, when you think about it, what was the government is saying, we don't believe what people testified to under oath in the prior grand jury and in the trial, and we're then going to use the powers of our office to go after people again. What does that mean? Well, it creates an incredible coercive atmosphere so that people will say what the government wants them to say.
Hmm. So, Tom, you deferred to the judge. Do you want to add to what the judge said?
I'd also add this, which is that I do think there's a lot of browbeating going on. It may be the last gasp. I think that the statute of limitations is up in May. And so, essentially, this is their last shot at trying to do so. I think, you know, there's been a record of going after speakers of the House. I think they want another pelt.
Okay, so I'm skating on thin ice here, but Judge Gertner, I take your philosophical point, but what about this idea that is it not part of the government's responsibility if indeed people did perjure themselves or lie to investigators to expand an investigation to ask those questions as well?
Well, that's true, but think about it this way. Every time someone is acquitted, Does that mean the government goes after all the witnesses in the case to say you must have perjured yourself? Or if they ever, here was a conviction, so now you go back and you say you must have perjured yourself. I mean, the government does not typically do this. So now we have a grand jury, the contents of which, by the way, was leaked by someone to the Globe, where it seems clear that what the government is fishing for is someone to say there was a real quid pro quo. We give you jobs, you give me something explicit. That was missing in the last case. Sure, it's possible that there was something explicit. It's also possible that the coercive pressure of the grand jury is going to lead someone to say that when it wasn't true.
Hmm. Well, on that thin ice, I will retreat back to the shore.
With this weather, we're still thick ice. Don't worry.
Let's just spend a minute talking about the other major case that continues to be in the news, and that is the trial of admitted Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev. This week, jurors heard from experts on forensic evidence regarding the construction of the bombs that were exploded on Boylston Street. They also heard graphic descriptions of the deaths of Crystal Campbell. Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe said that upon seeing some of those photographs, some of the jurors looked ill, others looked mad, still others were crying. Tom, the prosecution is nearing the end of its case. Just your thoughts on the trial this week.
So I keep wondering when this going on, whether we have this kind of inflaming of the jury issue. I mean, we already know that that he did it. He has admitted that. The issue is going to be, does he get the death penalty or does he not get the death penalty? And I see stuff like this going on, and since you don't need the graphic description of the death in order to establish his guilt, it seems to me that what that's setting up is an effort to talk about the death penalty. I wonder if it backfires.
Mm. Now, Nancy, as the defense begins to put together its case after the prosecution closes its, where really are they going to go when they have a chance to put witnesses on the stand?
It's hard to know, but I think they've focused on two issues so far. One is the relationship between Tamerlan and Jokar, what the relationship between them was. And maybe there are additional details that didn't come out in the direct examination of the government witnesses and in their cross. So maybe there are details of that relationship. The other is the question of motive. The description of Marion Conrad, Bill Fix, cross-examination of government witnesses who thought they had found, you know, underlying jihadi meaning in stoner Twitter tweets, or in references on his computer, that I think they'll broaden that to suggest that this was a stoner who was playing around with ideas.
Now, if you were Tsarnaev's attorneys, would you put him on the stand?
No,
not at all. Yeah,
not in this stage. Conceivably, in the penalty phase, he has to testify, but not in the liability phase. People talk about putting a client on the stand. That was actually something you never do unless you are absolutely certain, because it means that everything else you did in the case pales in comparison. The entire case is on his shoulders. Mm. And so that's the difficulty.
All right. Well, we've got enough time left for our hubbubs, those little stories that caught the eye of our panelists this week, but maybe that didn't get the attention that they deserve. So, Tom, I'll come to you first. What's your hubbub?
So, first of all, I just want to say that I was going to tell you just how upset I am about the breakup of One Direction. It's been very hard for me to think about anything else. But a little bit closer to home, it is, despite the fact that we're supposed to have 3 inches of snow this weekend, it is, in fact, baseball season is coming upon us. We are going to have spring.
Hallelujah.
And, of course, now that baseball season is upon us, it is time for David Ortiz to have a fight with some reporter. Now he's having a fight. And Derek Jeter, after he retired, started this little blog where basically athletes can complain about, you know, how they're treated by the press. David Ortiz has a great piece on Derek Jeter's blog complaining about a certain reporter with red Jerry curl. And that, of course, refers to the Globe's Dan Shaughnessy, who is the indispensable sports reporter that manages to infuriate everybody. And I'm glad to see he's still infuriating David Ortiz.
Yeah, and by the way, it's a great piece that David Ortiz wrote, and we've got a link to it on radioboston.org. So I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah. Yeah, Nancy, you're up.
Well, I have to, every year at the NCAA tournament time, my husband and I have this running joke. You know, he watches it zealously, and, you know, I keep on saying I want to come up with a new kind of bracket, and the new kind of bracket to reflect the inanity of the way the radio announcers report this. Hmm. So my bracket would be, who are the powerhouses? Who are the perennial powerhouses? Who are the odds-on famous favorites? And best of all, which are the Cinderella teams? And then I'll figure it all out.
That's great. You did that really well, Nancy.
Thank you very much. I'm going to move into sports casting
now. That's your next niche.
Right.
ESPN, here we come.
All right. Magna, your turn.
Okay, so my hubbub takes us up to Portland, Maine. This is a story from our friends at the Bangor Daily News. Because apparently there is a growing group of folks who are moving to Portland from the New York borough of Brooklyn, right? Because they're looking for a place with authenticity, they say. And there's so many of them who've moved to Portland that they now call it Portlyn, P-O-R-T-L-Y-N. And these are hipsters, sorry hipsters, who've told the Bangor Daily News, how can we keep our New York City jobs and get out of the tri-state area? It's cheaper in Portland. The food is great. Some people find jobs. Other people have said they love living there because it's cheaper to fly to New York City twice a week to work than it is to live anywhere in the tri-state area.
Wow.
So, you know, I have to say that if you are a Brooklyn hipster and you're looking for authenticity by keeping your New York City lifestyle in Portland, Maine, maybe you ought to reassess what you think about the word authenticity.
Well said. All right. So my hubbub involves New Hampshire's deer population and plans by the New Hampshire Department of Fish and Game to revise its deer management plan for the first time in 10 years. Now, some folks say this is long overdue because they say the local deer population is out of control. That's a matter of debate that I'm not going to get into. But Angela Fitzpatrick, she's a resident of New Boston, New Hampshire, might have reason to believe that the deer population is out of control, because here's what happened, according to a story in the Union Leader this week. She had ordered pizza, sat down at her kitchen table to read her email when a deer, a good-sized deer, we're led to believe, crashed through her kitchen window and landed right in front of her on the kitchen floor. It skidded frantically around the house for the next 10 minutes as her husband tried in vain to get it to go out an open door. Instead, the frightened doe ran through the kitchen, through the hallway, through the living room, knocked over the Christmas tree. And here I got to say, the Christmas tree? I mean, it's almost April. What's with that? But anyway, upended furniture, tore down curtains, and finally crashed through a plate glass door and ran away, leaving a trail of chaos and some bloody tufts of fur. And according to the story, Fitzpatrick and her husband spent yesterday cleaning up their house and talking to their insurance
company.
Did
they get the pizza?
Yeah, I don't know if they got the pizza. The deer might have. But what is that, a natural disaster, an act of God? I'm just wondering what you tell the insurance folks. Anyway, Nancy Gertner, former federal judge and professor at Harvard Law School. Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you.
And Tom Keene is a former city councilor and contributor to the Boston Globe. Tom, always a pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure.
When we come back, 22% of all native plant species in New England are either rare or extinct. We'll find out why. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.